Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. And on this week's show, we'll be chatting with James Kettle of Port Swigger Web Security about some adventures he had with reverse proxies and malformed host headers. Using some simple tricks, James was able to do some crazy stuff and earn himself about 30 grand in bounties very, very quickly. He's turned some of these techniques into tools for Burp Suite, so he'll be joining us in a little while to talk about that. In this week's sponsor interview, we're tackling the new European General Data Protection Regulation. With the new regime due to kick in on May 25 next year, there's a lot of angst out there about the new regulation, and for good reason. The penalties for mishandling information are now up to 4% of global turnover, which is a stiff enough penalty to strike fear into the hearts of CEOs everywhere. Senatas is this week's sponsor. They make Layer 2 encryption equipment, as well as SureDrop, a GDPR and enterprise-friendly Dropbox-style service. Senatas Europe's Managing Director, Graham Wallace, will join the show this week to talk about some of the ins and outs of the GDPR. Stay tuned for that. But first up, as always, it's time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, we begin with some reporting from the New York Times, which, as it turned out, it had some problems, let us say, which is a shame because there's a lot of very interesting stuff in this piece.
Yeah, so the story that's being reported is that there's this guy who was writing some malware who lives in the Ukraine, goes by the handle Profexa online, and he was writing and selling, amongst other things, a remote access Trojan on some underground forum somewhere. And the story is going that one of his pieces of malware was used by some Russian hacking crew. The story originally said Fancy Bear versus the DNC, although that's one of the bits that's now been walked back. And then he, either through concern for his own well-being or some sense of moralness or whatever else, turned himself into the Ukrainian police and is now assisting the Ukrainian police and the FBI as a witness in some of the Russian investigations of Russian hacking. And again, originally this was conflated with the intrusion into the DNC, although that does not now appear to be the case. The particular piece of malware that he wrote was included in one of the other sets of kind of tools that are being attributed to Russian hacking crews, but not one that was actually used in the DNC based on the public information that we have at the moment. So yeah, a little bit of a mess. The New York Times walked back some of those little bits, but yeah, there's been a bit of back and forth about the quality of the attribution, and of course then the actual nature of the assistance that this guy is providing, or indeed whether that aspect of the story rings true. I'm not sure.
So look, I mean, long story short, the article was based on a faulty premise, and the way that they got there was they actually were relying on the Grizzly Step report, which was, of course, released in the wake of the DNC hacks, but didn't just deal with the actors that were responsible for the DNC hacks. So that's how they got confused, presumably.
Yeah, I think that's certainly what Krebs's understanding is. And Krebs has written up a piece kind of talking about his take on this. And yeah, the Grizzly Step report seems to be where that set of IOCs came from. Of course, Grizzly Step report had a whole grab bag of IOCs, not all of which necessarily were in exclusive use by Russians. So it was kind of used as in the fallout from the DNC for people to go and check whether they've been owned by Russians, but not necessarily as a particularly high quality piece of intelligence.
Well, I mean, that report caught a lot of shit when it came out, and we're still mopping it up, which is great. Well done, US US intelligence community. Switching gear for a moment, and this is a hilarious story, I think. Proton Mail. There was some phishing campaign against Proton Mail, and by the looks of things, what they actually did is they owned the web server that was hosting the phishing page and took it down. Then they tweeted at someone, "Oh yeah, like we owned that web server and took away that phishing page." And everyone's like, "You what?" And then they deleted the tweet and kind of aren't commenting on it. Now, the reason I wanted to talk about this is I had a discussion in Las Vegas with a friend of mine who is very interested in this concept of hacking back, and they're trying to do some policy work in that area. But a lot of the policy discussions that are happening now sort of ignore the fact that this is pretty routine these days to do this sort of thing. I mean, it's illegal, but people are still doing it, is my point.
Of course. And yeah, I mean, hackers are rubbish at securing their stuff. Like, hacker infrastructure is bodged together. Hacker code is rubbish. There's plenty of opportunity to do it. And it is really effective. But yeah, it's one of those things that everyone does, but no one talks about because, you know, A, it's illegal.
It's illegal. B, yeah, don't tweet about it. Like, but this is funny that one sort of slipped through the net and there's, you know, just someone had a brain fade and tweeted about it. And then there's like Q outrage. But I mean, this is not the first time this has happened.
Well, no, there's been plenty of, you know, of cases where people have done this kind of thing. And yeah, you just kind of don't mention, you know, you kind of parallel construct anything you get from owning the C2 infrastructure or, you know, owning where the phishing goes or whatever else. So yeah, just Proton Mail, just don't tweet about it next time.
Yeah, that's just everybody keep it shtum. Cryptocurrency fail of the week, $500,000 missing. That previously belonged to people behind something called Enigma. What is Enigma?
They had like a pre-release thing where they were doing an ICO where they were selling tokens that were redeemable for Ethereum, and they were doing like a pre-sale for backers in a small group. Somebody owned their website, their Slack, like all of their other comms mechanisms, and then sent out a message saying, hey, we've decided to open it up to the public. Would you mind, you know, going and giving us your money? And they had, of course, had substituted out the destination address for one that the attackers controlled. And yeah, $500,000 went off to the attackers. And because of Ethereum being Ethereum, that's just what happens. You know, welcome to the jungle, eh?
Yeah, well, I mean, my favorite one recently was the where they just owned up the WordPress blog and changed the address on the blog. And I think they got like millions of dollars out of that. So this is a thing that happens that we shouldn't find funny because, you know, honest, hardworking people are losing their money. But it is kind of funny.
Yeah, but there's just so many people in the cryptocurrency world who are there trying to make a quick buck. And really, you know, people are losing money because lots of people are greedy.
Yeah. Staying with cryptocurrency, and Joseph Cox has filed a report for his new place of employment, the Daily Beast. Apparently, the US Tax Office, the Internal Revenue Service, is, you know, has bought some tools designed to track stuff through the blockchain. I mean, that in itself is something you would expect, but something that was really interesting is that the IRS claims that in 2015, only 802 people declared Bitcoin losses or profits in the whole year, right? So I'm guessing the true number of people who should have declared earnings or losses via Bitcoin will be somewhat higher than that, Adam.
Just a little bit higher, perhaps. Yes, certainly now that Bitcoin's gone all the way up to crazy amounts of money, like $3,000 or $4,000, something like that. But yeah, that's a very, very small number, and that I suppose you know is a reasonable incentive for the IRS to go out and. In this case, I think they've brought in software and tooling from the company Chainalysis, and they're paying them to help figure out blockchains and, you know, understand what the ledger can tell them about people's cryptocurrency movements. Obviously, there's lots of other cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin for people to hide their money from the tax man in, but the tax man, he'll get there eventually, one hopes.
Yeah, and the thing is, right, if you start tumbling your coins and, you know, to dodge tax, you better make sure you do it well. And you have to assume, too, that these tumbling services might be compelled to cooperate with the tax office, right? So
might even be operated by them in the way we go with the FBI operating proxy services and you know, child porn sites and things. I wouldn't be surprised if the IRS decided to run a Tumblr or something and entrap people. But I don't know whether US law lets them do that, but I mean, maybe they should.
Yeah, I have no idea, right? And there's just, I mean, we're talking about substantial amounts of cash now, which is what's going to make tax offices around the world increasingly au fait with cryptocurrencies. Funnily enough, too, Bleeping Computer has reported on a couple of cryptocurrency mining, like some mining malware. There's one for Linux devices that's like a written by someone who's a big fan of Brian Krebs.
Yeah, this one, I don't know that it's going to be particularly widespread, but it's using a telnet brute force approach to compromise boxes and then runs up a cryptocurrency miner. And yeah, the source code does appear to make requests to KrebsOnSecurity.com and presumably say hi to Brian. I don't imagine he gets the proceeds from the mining, although you would hope that all the things you could get with telnet brute forcing would be well and truly brute forced out by now, but apparently not.
I mean, this story is the perfect blend of 21st and 20th century cybersecurity news, really, when you think about it. So that's interesting. There's another one too that's going around hosing boxes via these, SMB V1, unpatched SMB V1 exploits using Eternal Blue and stuff to load them up.
Yeah, yep. So anyone who hasn't patched that and didn't get owned by all of the other things that have been using Eternal Blue, and this is not even the first cryptocurrency mining worm to use Eternal Blue. Yeah, if anyone left in the pool of vulnerable to Eternal Blue machines, you might in fact be mining cryptocurrencies for somebody else. But yes, I guess, I don't know, if you haven't patched your boxes yet and you didn't get ransomware, then I guess you've been spinning that particular Russian roulette gun barrel for a while.
Well, so. You should be thankful that you're just being used to mine bitcoins. It could have been be a lot worse. You could be paying those bitcoins. Maybe you could get the mining Trojan to mine you some bitcoins to pay for the second stage, which is the ransomware, Just close the loop on that.
Synergy.
There we go.
Out of it.
Staying with Bleeping Computer, they've run a lot of good stuff this week. They've got a really interesting piece up here about how you can use the data collected by online advertisers to sort of pin down and de-anonymize Bitcoin transactions.
Yeah, and I thought this is actually a really interesting angle. So this is using the intelligence that ad serving companies on the internet already have to tie together people as they move across websites and around the internet and profiling people's browsers to figure out who they are, and then using that to correlate transactions on, Bitcoin exchanges or other cryptocurrency exchanges and the rest of your browsing through the kind of process of that the ad companies use. And it's not an unrealistic thing. Like, if you think back to that IRS story a second ago, that they could go to some of these advertising companies and, ask them to hand over that kind of correlation information would be an interesting tactic. But yeah, so using what advertisers are already well incentivized financially to do and then tying that together with, figuring out how people use their Bitcoin accounts and how they use their other accounts. So yeah, it's quite a smart approach, I thought.
Now, last week, the news dropped that the key that encrypts Apple's iOS Secure Enclave firmware, that key has been cracked and made public. And there was a lot of funny reporting on that saying, oh my God, it's the end of the SEP. But it's not. I mean, it just means that researchers can get access to the firmware and start having a bit of a poke at it. ThreatPost actually has a great write-up of this, which draws heavily, funnily enough, on a podcast that we did where we interviewed David Wang of Azimuth about the talk they did last year at Black Hat about the SEP. It's interesting, right? I mean, it's not the end of the world. Early on, the reporting from a bunch of outlets was, sort of doing a lot of arm flapping, but... yeah, it's not the end of the world, but it is interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, there's interesting. I think there's a couple of points here. The first is, of course, the fact the firmware is now available in the clear through the fact that the key has been leaked means that if you want to do reverse engineering, the sorts of things that David Wang and Tajir and Matthew Solnick did for their Black Hat talk, if you do want to do that kind of research, you've now got an easier way to start reverse engineering. You don't have to find a bug first to then go and understand the inner workings of the secure enclave. So that's that's not a bad thing. It's good for security researchers. The other aspect of the story that's interesting is how that key kind of got out there, which someone posted this key with no explanation of how they derived it or recovered it or cracked it or whatever else, and no further information, which is quite funny. So yeah, Apple have kind of confirmed it is the real thing. It is in fact the real key in question, but yeah, how and why is an interesting thing that we don't know. So that will probably, I'm sure, some more story will come up eventually about that, but yeah, interesting.
Now, of course, too, Adam, you can't just find a bug in SEP and then off you go exploiting it. That's not how this works, right? You're going to have some pretty privileged access to the device itself, like jailbreaking it or something like that, yeah?
Yeah, you'd have to have an exploit that gave you, kernel-level access or at least, root-level access. Clearly, that's not, super straightforward.
Now, staying with mobile, Adam, Ars has a write-up here of a Usenix paper that I understand you read, which is an interesting one, right? It looks at the hardware trojaning of smartphone screens. So the idea is, you take your phone to get a screen repair and someone gives you one with a built-in Trojan. How does this work?
What they implemented, I guess, is sort of man in the middle between the touchscreen controller and the screen controller and the rest of the phone. And they implemented with some kind of proof of concept hardware that's kind of big and bulky and would need miniaturizing to be used in the wild. But yeah, it's an interesting piece of research in the sense that it's they've actually done it, which is nice. Although in terms of a regular person's threat model, I mean, if someone's got physical access to your phone, we kind of assume that
Well, we used to. Yeah. We used to, and now we don't, right? And this, I mean, can you imagine swapping out someone's iPhone screen, you know, while they're sleeping or something, and then bang, they wake up, whack in their passcode, and then you've got it.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the difference between the sort of the evil maid class of attacks where you have temporary control of a device, you modify its hardware, and then you give it back to the person they don't know, versus the case of your device is seized by the FBI and now they want into it. Like that, and those are, you know, that's sort of the difference between a single touch attack and a multi-touch where you compromise the hardware and then give it back to the person doesn't know, and then they enter their credentials. And that kind of thing is a slightly different threat model to the one that has been, you know, more thoroughly addressed, which is the your phone's been seized by the police kind of scenario. But yeah, this one is clearly in the latter category where you modify it and then people type in their credentials and you steal them. And that's, you know, the case for a lot of modern hardware that is not well protected against. Things like, you know, secure boot and TPM modules and stuff try, but yeah, it's quite complicated. And if you're modifying, you know, the keyboard in your TPM equipped laptop, well, you know, you're going to get my full descriptor password. So yeah, it's, you know, it's a bit of a threat model. I think we all kind of understand that physical access does win, especially in that scenario. But yeah, it's kind of fun to see it actually done rather than just be theoretical.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Google has released Android 8.0. They've called that Oreo. So that one is gradually rolling out as we speak. So that's interesting. Staying with Android, though, about 500 apps have been booted out of the App Store because they've been linked to this sort of shady Chinese SDK.
Yeah, so this was an SDK provided for like an advertising platform, and it's kind of not clear whether it was just badly engineered or whether it is actually genuinely malicious. But this ad SDK basically provided a mechanism for remote code execution on a device. Like it would just like download and execute, you know, Android DEX files from the internet, which, you know, clearly allows you to then do a whole bunch of stuff that an ad network shouldn't do. Developers were using this in their ads to in their apps to monetize them, and, you know, without really understanding that they were including a remote access, you know, malware framework. Some of these apps are like 100 million downloads or something. So yeah, it's not a, you know, it's not a great look for the app stores, well, for Google's app store in this case, to have that kind of thing. But yeah, you know, obviously ad networks have just been a cancer on everybody, you know, for a long time, serving malware and all sorts of things. And yeah, having them embedded in your apps just kind of continues that.
Chrome, meanwhile, has actually taken some steps to somewhat mitigate this issue of dodgy extensions and, you know, formerly legitimate extensions being acquired by shady people and turned into malware.
Yeah, so Google are introducing a couple of pop-up warnings. One, if you have your proxy settings reconfigured, and another, if a plugin tries to change your default search engine or change the homepage. So yeah, they're sort of prominent pop-ups that prompt you to go, hey, this is what I expected. If not, there's a restore your settings button, which is kind of cool. They're also modifying the mechanisms by which extension developers are allowed to modify settings. There's a specific settings override API that extensions now must use, and Google's going to throw out apps from the Chrome App Store that don't use the approved mechanism. So that will give them a little bit more control and presumably a better way to audit programmatically for this kind of thing.
There's a lull of the week sort of story, which is a couple in the United States found some sort of bug in, you know, this is like a total amateur bug bounty hour. They found some problem with Lowe's gift card program and wound up stealing like $12,971 worth of stuff. They'd ordered like $250,000 worth of gear. They got caught and the cops had to turn up with like an 18-foot trailer to haul away all the shit that they'd ordered. But it's pretty funny, right? Because if there had been a bug bounty, they probably, you know, they probably would have made $13,000 out of this, you know?
It is pretty funny, yeah. But no, like clearly amateur hour stuff, you know, bugs and gift card systems are not a super complicated thing to find. But yeah, ordering $250,000 worth of stuff delivered to your house and then reselling it on Facebook groups. In one particular case, one of the things they ordered was multiple boxes of UGG boots.
There you go. Yes,
selling UGG boots on Facebook is not the way to get rich.
Well, they are very comfortable, Adam, so there is that. Maersk, meanwhile, you know, we spoke about the impact of NotPetya to global logistics and also, you know, Merck Pharmaceuticals had a very hard time. I mean, we've heard that there's been serious disruptions to internal operations there, including like, you know, actual live samples of stuff that they use to produce vaccines having to go into the bin. That's the extent of it at Merck. Maersk, meanwhile, is reporting a $300 million loss stemming from NotPetya. I mean, that is one for the slide deck, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Like we've seen so many, you know, examples of you know, money lost to cyber attacks where the numbers are just complete made up rubbish. And this is, you know, an actual proper, you know, honest to God, state sponsored, presumably, cyber attack that has caused, $300 million worth of damage to a major shipping company. And they're still struggling to get everything back in line and back working. So, yeah, that's, that is absolutely one for all of the kind of, you know, high level, you know, briefings to the board about the cybers slide deck. If you need an example, everybody, there you go.
There you go. Now, I want to shift gears here for a moment, Adam, and talk about a bit of an issue with you. EFF came out last week with a blog post really looking at this issue of GoDaddy, giving Daily Stormer the boot, right? Now, this is that neo-Nazi website. GoDaddy gave them the boot. They signed up with Google. Google gave them the boot. They went onto a Tor hidden service. They later popped back up on the clear web using a .ru domain. Russia has given them the boot as well. So I presume they're sort of back on an onion service. EFF has written this big post. Now, keep in mind, this comes hot on the heels of ACLU, helping the alt-right hold its rally in Charlottesville. So let's keep that in mind. The EFF is doing its part for the alt-right and saying that this is very concerning that this website can't find service. And I got to say, I really disagree with that, but I'm curious to know your thoughts, Adam, because it's my view that if you don't want to host someone's hate speech, to me, that is a form of freedom of speech. And indeed, the First Amendment in the United States protects people. The courts in America have determined that the First Amendment protects you from compelled speech as well. You don't have to say anything that you don't want. Keep in mind, this is the First Amendment deals with the government as well. It's saying the government can't restrict speech or force you to say something. When it comes to something like this, I don't see a problem with a domain name registrar or a company like Google kicking Nazis off their platforms.
Yeah, I mean, I see what the EFF is saying, but yeah, I don't like Nazis. And I mean, their argument is that, you know, this is a slippery slope, and if we start letting the infrastructure of the internet decide who gets to speak, then that's a bad thing. But the thing is, the internet is a global network. There are people who I am sure would host their rubbish. In fact, there is, right? We've seen Ars was reporting earlier on that some, you know, tiny little no-name ass clown outfit had stepped up to host it. Of course, I think that lasted probably about 10 minutes. But yeah, I mean, there will be people who are willing to host them. They just have to go look hard enough, and they haven't. They've fallen back to running behind Tor. And we'll talk, I guess, in a second about what the Tor project thinks about that. But yeah, like, it's, you know, if you don't want to do business with Nazis, then no one should compel you to do so.
I won't even do business with Trend Micro. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's the thing. And I sent a tweet to that effect the other day, which resulted in a somewhat hilarious email landing in my inbox this morning. Let me just find it.
I know where this is going.
Hi there, my name is Dana and I'm a producer for Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News. Hope all is well. Checking in to see if you'd be able to assist me with an interview request for Patrick Gray. I had seen that he had spoken out against the EFF's criticism of tech companies cracking down on hate groups. We were wondering if he'd be interested in joining Tucker on the show to explain why he's against the EFF's actions. Please let me know if this is something he'd be interested in doing. This would be live in the 8 p.m. ET hour and one-on-one with Tucker. We can accommodate from a studio near him. Thank you. Dana. So I mean, if I was going to do that appearance, and it, you know, I'm not, but if I was going to do that appearance, I'd say, first of all, I find it pretty funny that the same people who get very vocal about bakers, defending the right of bakers to not make wedding cakes for same-sex couples, are really critical of Google withdrawing service from Nazis. That seems a bit of a double standard. I'd also point out that Fox News is unlikely to take advertising dollars from the Muslim Brotherhood. As you said, Adam, if you can't find service on the internet, like somewhere on the internet, then maybe you're just toxic, right? And the tribe has spoken. People can sort this out. I don't think the government should be involved necessarily in revoking people's domain names, but that's not what happened in this case. Cloudflare, Google, GoDaddy all said, no, you're toxic. We're not going to do business with you. It is a business decision. Where this gets really interesting, you know, and there is the slippery slope argument, but Americans seem very focused on this idea of precedence and process. You know, show me the process where, we've made a determination that to host these people is bad, but say, you know, but that still protects other causes or groups that we might want to protect. to us outside of America, that sort of just seems a little bit stupid because it sort of eliminates common sense from the calculation. Because, of course, okay, today it's Nazis and they say, well, tomorrow it could be this other group of people that we don't want silenced. And you know, my position is, well, let's wait until it's that group. Do you know what I mean? Let's kick up a stink then, because now doesn't seem the right time to do it. Now, one interesting side effect of this this whole conversation is some people in the Tor community, because of course, you know, Daily Stormer is now running an onion service on the so-called dark web. Some people in Tor are saying maybe we should, you know, offer up a patch so that we can block this hidden service. Now, when you've got people who make an anti-censorship tool openly discussing patching you out of their ecosystem, I find that very interesting. Of course, I don't think that's going to happen in a million years unless, and this is where it gets interesting, unless hosting such a toxic service results in a threat to the Tor network's viability itself. I can imagine someone DDoSing them pretty hard, or hard enough that it soaks up enough Tor capacity that it becomes a legit problem for them. Although I think the more likely scenario is someone will decloak the true hosting address of some of these services and just knock them out that way. But it is possible that hosting this sort of material will become a problem for Tor. Can you see that?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, and we may well see some, you know, large-scale denial of service. And one of the interesting things that has come out of this is actually someone actually posted in the track for Tor and a patch, I think, to allow individual Tor relays to block by onion address so that individual operators of relays could, at their discretion, decide to just blacklist, Nazi sites, you know, hate people, hate speech, whatever else they disagree with on their Tor relays, which prompted a really interesting kind of set of discussions, in the medium of, tickets on a bug request, which, you know, itself is a, you know, comment on modern times, perhaps. But no, it was a really interesting discussion, you know, on the various sides and the people who are, you know, want the Tor network to remain out of it, and the people who say, well, we didn't run, you know, we don't spend our volunteer time running this service to host Nazis. And as you say, yeah, if even an anti-censorship network wants to throw you out, well, then yeah, maybe you should go away and think about what you've done.
I think the slippery slope argument is just such bullshit. I don't know what you think about that. I just think it really is. This is just a case of the tribe has spoken, and it just doesn't work that way. I mean, okay, we block Nazis now. Tomorrow we could be blocking Black Lives Matter, for example. It's like, well, no, because then you would have big problems as a company if you did withdraw service from a group like that.
Yeah, if Cloudflare threw them off or Google threw them off, then people would make Google and Cloudflare's, you know, lives and businesses uncomfortable, and they'd change their mind. I mean, it seems like, you know, the process is working to me, right?
It also feels like the ACLU and EFF are doing a pretty shitty job of picking their battles.
Well, yeah, sadly. And it's a pity because, I mean, traditionally they, you know, ACLU and the EFF are, you know, people and groups that we would mostly agree with. I mean, you know, there's plenty of people around my office who, you know, would donate money, have donated money to the EFF to support their cause. And they've done, you know, they do a lot of really good work. But sometimes, you know, sort of absolutism in these things is not a productive and not the right choice. And I think that's what they're struggling with here. You know, I see why they're doing it. And they, you know, obviously they having principled positions on these things, even when you do disagree with Nazis, and no one's suggesting that the EFF is, you know, in favor of there being Nazis. You know, having principled positions is important, right, for pulling the center point of the debate around. I mean, it's very similar to the, you know, the absolutist free software people and all that kind of thing. Like it is a useful thing to make these debates happen, but it doesn't mean that the absolute position is right.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a shame I missed my opportunity to chat one-on-one with Tucker in the United States. It is a shame, but you know, by the time I'd woken up in the morning, I think that producer had gone home for the day, but you know, and I would have gone into that fully understanding that he would have been attacking me as an anti-free speech person. I mean, how wild is it when I've got, you know, the Fox News Network emailing me and trying to get me on their program to frame me as an enemy of free speech? That is 2017, man. It's weird times.
Truly bizarre times, yeah.
Well, that's it for the week's news, Adam. I would say we'll speak to you next week, but you're having the week off. You're going off to your company conference, so I do hope you enjoy that. Haroon Mir will be next week's news guest. But, mate, thank you very much for your contribution this week, and we will chat to you again in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'll look forward to that then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. It is time for this week's feature interview now with James Kettle of PortSwigger Web Security. PortSwigger is the company that makes Burp Suite, every web app hacker's BFF. And recently, James decided to have a play with some funny host headers in web requests. He wanted to see if he could do unnatural things to reverse proxies. And the thing is, his exploration turned out to be wildly successful. As you'll hear, reverse proxies and load balancers really aren't doing a good job of handling host headers. So James was able to get many of his payloads to trigger not only on his target's proxies, but on a bunch of machines in between as well, like his ISP's transparent proxies and things like that. It's actually kind of hilarious. Now, of course, if someone can manipulate host headers and get your reverse proxy to scan internal resources for them, you are indeed a dumbass for configuring your network in that way. Don't do that. But as you will hear, connecting through to internal stuff is just the start. Between some weird caching behavior and some of the crawler behavior he could trigger, James opened up all sorts of possibilities for further research. He joined me via Skype for this interview.
It was really about targeting systems that people just aren't paying very much attention to. Like there's all these websites out there with reverse proxies and such, like sitting in front of them and like miles and miles of back-end systems. And it's quite hard to get a good handle on these systems. Like, you don't see any indications of them in the responses from the application necessarily.
Yeah.
And I feel as a result, they just get ignored.
Yeah, like they're like, oh, these things are transparent, right? And as you note in your blog post, like a load balancer that's doing its job, you don't know it's there.
Yeah. And like I got a little bit of inspiration from Shellshock, because that showed me there's attack surface out there that as soon as one person spots it, then everyone starts finding vulnerabilities in it.
So what you've done here, what I like about this is it's a cross between research and a cool story, because what you've basically done is, you know, had a bit of an idea about targeting, you know, some of these systems with some pretty simple technique, but you've kind of automated it. You've gone and prepared a spreadsheet of companies that are actually running bug bounties. You know, you've sort of fed that in as a giant target list and sort of rigged it all up and then just fired it off. You wound up making about, it was over 30 grand US in bug bounties in about 15 minutes. So why don't you walk us through that whole process?
So building up the pipeline took quite a lot of work, actually, because I had to manually review every bug bounty program to see if they allowed automated testing and work out what the scope was. That took a couple of days and was not very exciting, but the resulting spreadsheet has come in useful a lot of times over the years. So using that spreadsheet, I was able to generate a regular expression which would match any domain name that was in scope, and then I could just run that against a humongous list of domain names and generate a list of sites that matched. So that ended up matching about 5 million different A records, I think, ish, which had about 70,000 live web servers in it. And then using Zgrab, which no one seems to have heard of. I hadn't heard of it myself. I used MassScan to begin with, but Zgrab's way better. Using Zgrab, I was able to fire payloads at those targets. And if I wasn't rate limiting myself, I could probably send one request to every target in the space of about 30 seconds.
Yeah, that's...
I slowed it down.
That's an awful lot of owning in 30 seconds. Let's talk about the payload, but I just want to note too, because one of the funny things in this blog post is when you started firing off some of these payloads that were really designed to mess with things like reverse proxies, it started breaking all of the it started firing on all of your like ISP's transparent proxies, which I just think is kind of hilarious, unless you're the admin at the ISP, and then you're probably going to be freaking out. But why don't you actually talk us through these payloads that you started bouncing around? Because again, this is not really that outrageously complicated. These payloads were fairly simple.
Yeah. The one that I started with, which is actually the one that worked on the most unique targets, which is... there's a bunch of load balancers out there that simply route the request to whatever host is specified in the host header. So you just change the host header to some internal IP and they'll route your request to some internal IP. And it's that simple. It's really, really easy.
And then you can just start hopping around, guessing, you know, scanning internal ranges, stuff like that. I mean, is that something that you can actually do in a bug bounty program, or do they get the irrits when you start trying to hop around on internal ranges?
Good question. It varies depending on the bug bounty. I did that with New Relic, and they were very happy with that. And with Yahoo, I scanned their internal ranges and used that to find something that I could take control over, and I got a 15 grand bounty for that, but they did tell me, if you ever do that again, we're going to ban you from the program.
That's such a Yahoo response, man. They just,
yeah,
they always ban people for owning them just a little bit too hard in their like owning program, you know. That's just kind of how they work. Yeah, okay, so there we go, we got just something as simple as specifying an internal range you know, in the host header, and then bang, it fires. But you didn't stop there. There was a lot of other little tricks that you used, right?
Yes. Stuff like, some of them will have a whitelist for the host header, but if you specified an absolute URL in the request line, sometimes that would override the host header. So even though they've got some kind of whitelist for the value of the host header or some other kind of protection, for example, Cloudflare sites verify that the value in the host header matches the SNI field, even if they're doing that, this will bypass that and mean that I could still get access to their internal network.
One of my favorite things actually was that a lot of these back-end systems, and that's the thing, you don't even know often where these payloads are going to actually wind up and where they're going to trigger and where they're going to fire. One of the things I really liked is that there were some of the analytics packages that basically have like crawlers in them that would then actually start crawling whatever URL you specified, which could be really handy, because then you might be able to grab the user agent string of that crawler, and if it's something reasonably accessible, you might be able to pick it apart, maybe find a bug in that crawler, and then, you know, you can load up an exploit for it to crawl, and then bang. I mean, that might be a way to get shell, right?
Yes, that's where maybe the most potential for further research is at the moment, because I found tons and tons of these systems. They're much more common than I expected, but exploiting them is pretty difficult, and I was able to exploit a few but not get any bounties from it. But the majority of them, I found them, but I didn't have the tooling to exploit them, which is part of the reason that we've made Hackability, which probes these crawlers, just to give you a decent like a fast black box photo of what might be good leads to exploit these crawlers.
Yeah, so we should point out that you've actually sort of turned this into a tool, right? I mean, it's a BERT plugin now.
Yeah, so we made a couple of tools. I made Collaborator Everywhere, which augments your BERT traffic and helps you find these systems. And we also made Hackability, which is a website which you can get these crawlers to connect to. Actually, on Friday, I realized that I actually made quite a big mistake with Collaborator Everywhere, which I haven't publicly mentioned so far, but there's no reason why I can't. It's not a mistake that affects the users of it, actually. It's a mistake that affects us. So one of the things that Collaborator Everywhere does is it puts a BERT collaborator URL in the exported for header, right? Which means that you can tell whether a website is trusting this header to accurately specify the IP address of a visitor. So if that triggers, then that tells you this website is vulnerable to IP spoofing. But due to the design of the collaborator, that IP address resolves to the public BERT collaborator server. And, well, I don't know if you can see where this going is, but on Friday, we got an abuse report from Amazon saying our collaborator server had been trying to brute force into someone's website.
Oh, dear.
And this is a server that doesn't send any outbound traffic whatsoever. But eventually we figured it out. And basically, I've effectively framed the BERT collaborator server for all of the traffic that everyone that uses this extension sends.
I got to ask, were you surprised that it was this easy to cause this much mayhem with some simple tricks?
Yes, certainly. You always think that you're going to do some damage, but the scale of it, the scale of this was absolutely ridiculous. Like, I only talked in that blog post about like 10% of the stuff that I found, just because there was a huge amount of stuff.
And of course, when you were taking like a HTTP path, you know, to your targets, you were getting payloads firing like at multiple steps along the way, right?
Yeah. I got absolutely flooded with pingbacks. And one of the trickiest parts to begin with was figuring out which target caused which pingback and so on. And some of them I never figured it out even.
Yeah, you were just getting pingbacks from some random server or load balancer or a transparent proxy or something over there, like, and you got no idea why.
Yes, like there was one system that was pinging me every 24 hours, and because of DNS's recursive nature, even from the IP address that was pinging me, I had no idea which target had caused that behavior, and I was never able to figure it out.
So what would you suggest? I mean, obviously all of the pen testers listening and all of the bug bounty participants listening, I mean, they've got something to do. They can go check out these tools. But what would you suggest, you know, actual, you know, defensive security people should do to deal with this? Because the last thing you really want is for your networking gear to allow someone to just sort of hop around on your internal network by specifying a funny, you know, host header.
Yeah. I think ultimately you've got to acknowledge that reverse proxies are designed to proxy user traffic, and therefore it only takes a tiny bug to make them proxy user traffic in a way in which you didn't expect. So they're basically VPNs for members of the public.
So maybe just, you know, go back to your network fundamentals is what you pack of dumbasses seems to be what you're saying.
Exactly, pretty much.
Yeah.
Like, make sure the reverse proxy doesn't have network level access to anything sensitive.
Mm.
I was seeing stuff like unauthenticated admin panels in some of the networks, and it's like, you don't want that on the same network.
And that's why you got 30 grand.
Yeah. There's one extra exploit, which I think is worth mentioning, which is the instance of a reverse proxy that was scanning the responses from the server looking for static resource imports. So there are these proxies which they cache content being served back to users, and they're so enthusiastic to do this that if they see any references to other pieces of content in the responses that they're looking at, then they'll send a request themselves to fetch these other resources.
But why?
And that means
sorry, but I'm like, but why?
Well, yeah, who knows. Yeah. And so that means that if an application happens to have cross-site scripting, obviously that's a lot of applications.
So you can just get it to start like sucking in whatever the hell you want, right?
Yeah, right. You can trick them into importing internal stuff and then caching it, and then you can just grab it straight out of their cache.
That's and like, terrible.
Yeah. And this is basically you're escalating cross-site scripting to server-side request watchery.
Yeah, that's pretty special.
Yeah. That was my favorite one.
I note this research has resulted already in a patch to Apache HTTP components. So, you know, yay, good work. But were there any, like, what other software made the shame list? I'm just curious.
To be honest, I didn't get very much insight into what software was causing this. With Yahoo, I was exploiting a lot of servers running Apache Traffic Server, which was made by Yahoo. So I would guess those servers that it's easy to misconfigure. I saw a lot of Bluecoat proxies and the like, but ultimately I think basically any reverse proxy has the capability to be vulnerable to this. It's just a matter of configuring it right or having the wrong code. Like, some of the stuff that I saw was definitely 100% custom code. There was no way that was an off-the-shelf.
So I guess, you know, I mean, look, I think you're going to make people, by releasing these tools, you're going to make, and writing this post, you're going to make a lot of money for a lot of bug hunters. And let's just hope that listeners out there actually have a bug bounty program so that someone might turn it up.
Yep.
Or maybe they need to go grab a copy of Burp and have a crack at it themselves. James Kettle, thank you very much for your time.
Cool. Thank you.
That was James Kettle of PortSwigger Web Security there, and I've linked through to the blog post he did about this research, and it is well worth a read. Okay, we're going to shift gears somewhat for this week's sponsor interview. This week's show is brought to you by Senatas Security. Senatas is an Australian company with a global presence, and this week we are chatting with the Senatas Europe Managing Director, Graham Wallace, all about GDPR. The General Data Protection Regulation is a set of regulations being introduced by the European Union with the aim of strengthening and unifying data protection for individuals within the EU. It covers the movement of personal data outside EU borders and introduced concepts like the right to be forgotten. Organisations covered by the GDPR, which may be companies just doing business in Europe but owned elsewhere, will have to achieve privacy and data protection by default. And if you fail, well, these sanctions are stiff. Fines in the order of 4% of global turnover. Graham Wallace joined me to go over the GDPR, what it could mean for security people, and how likely it is that the regulators will be tough on enforcement. Here's what he said.
The European Union had a system called the Data Protection Directive, which covered a lot of the same kind of territory, but it was implemented in a different way. So it had all 28 countries were understanding it slightly differently and applying it slightly differently. So there was a lot of inconsistency, but also a failure to recognise that, a failure to see the future, really, because obviously what we can do now is we can identify people by their location, by the MAC address on their device, by all sorts of other methods that weren't imagined in 1995.
And it's funny what you say, too, about every country having its own interpretation, because I remember, you know, a long time ago, Australia negotiated a free trade agreement with the United States. And if you actually look at the laws that were passed by each country, they didn't actually match all that well, which I always thought was funny. It never, you know, in the time since, it hasn't actually caused us trouble. But these sorts of broad agreements tend to be implemented very, very differently. And I guess GDPR is trying to rectify that.
Absolutely, yes. So you've got one sort of overarching authority that will seek to apply the GDPR regulations. So there should not be any distinction between the now 27 members, or it will be 27 members once the UK obviously leaves the Union. So already I guess that creates a complication, but the UK is looking to introduce mirror legislation so that we will follow GDPR in the same way that it's understood across Europe.
As I understand GDPR, like, even it doesn't really matter whether or not you're in Europe. If you're doing business with Europe and handling the information of Europeans, you sort of have to comply, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one of the things that came only last week is Microsoft announcing that they will be GDPR compliant in their cloud services. So already the big companies are recognising that there is going to be an obligation on them regardless of where they're based, and they are going to have to look lively to solve this and make sure they comply. Otherwise, well, let's be honest, GDPR regulators are going to be looking to use the teeth they've been given with this legislation. They're not going to just be sitting by.
Yeah, someone's going to be the case study, right? And you don't want it to be you.
absolutely not.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, you know, some of these financial regulations that we see across the world as well. I mean, I'm thinking specifically in this case of things like Sarbanes-Oxley, where a number of companies that trade, you know, they're not even based in the United States, but they're doing a lot of business there. They have to be Sarbox compliant. It's the same sort of thing. Now, of course, you know, Senatas makes layer 2 encryption equipment. Is there any sort of idea, you know, do we have any idea about whether or not, you know, layer 2 links like between campuses are going to be covered by this?
Obviously, we're going to have to see to some extent how the regulation actually gets applied. But certainly the implication is that there's almost going to be a presumption of guilt rather than a presumption of innocence on behalf of the company. It's not going to be good enough to say, oh, I didn't know there was sensitive data going across that link. I didn't know such and such was storing sensitive information on that folder. You're going to have to know where your data is. You're going to have to know where it's going, and you're going to have to take appropriate precautions. I'll just read. This is actually from the legislation.
Yeah, I was going to ask for a quote to define what appropriate is, you know. So here we go. Please let us know.
Okay, so lawfulness of processing and security of processing components state that appropriate safeguards, which may include encryption or pseudonymization, should be an integral part of handling personal data.
So yeah, that's real clear and prescriptive, isn't it?
The presumption is there, I think, that you will use encryption and pseudonymization rather than not. Yeah, so it will be exceptional if you don't need to use those techniques in order to protect personal data.
So you mentioned an interesting thing, which is you feel like the regulators will want to pull the trigger on sanctions, like they'll want to send a signal to the market. I mean, what makes you say that? I mean, do you really think they are going to be hot to trot and pull the trigger on penalties and sanctions?
I think so. It seems to be a general feeling around the market, the European Union, that we would expect most likely a household name, someone in the high end, to be fined, to be called out on their practices. And let's be honest, in a lot of cases, that it's going to be quite justified calling people out because...
Yeah, they're not going to have to look hard to find egregious breaches of like data protection standards, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, even simple little things like GDPR brings forward the right to be forgotten, which we've obviously heard a lot about in the last couple of years. But that's right in the regulations. So even if you fail to delete the record you've been asked to delete from one of your backups or one of your archives, that's still a breach. So you might have deleted it from your main data center traffic and servers, but if there are residual copies of that data, then that can be deemed a breach. And obviously that brings in the need to control where the data is, as I was saying at the start. And I think what a lot of companies will do is they will try and reduce the number of locations that the sensitive data is located in and sort of reduce their risk footprint.
See, to me, it really does feel like GDPR is more about data handling and what companies are allowed to do with the data in their normal operations. And, you know, it's a very powerful regulation and you know, some would say justifiably so. But it seems like they've added the security component to this almost like an afterthought, but you've still got the same possible sanctions, right? So that puts people in an uncomfortable position where they're like, hey, you know, you were supposed to be going after people doing these horrible things to people's private data. And now what? You're going to ding us because we've got some, you know, shitty bug in one of our web applications? I mean, is that the feeling among the security people that you speak to in the EU?
No. I mean, I think the security people in the EU, to be honest, see this as a good business opportunity, as do a lot of EU companies, because what the EU is effectively able to say with this new regulation is, if you do your business here, if you store your data here, then it will be secure. We will not leak your personal data into the public arena. So the EU is trying to sort of put itself forward as the safe place for your information, I would suggest.
That's a very glass half full view, Graham, because when I was over at Black Hat and DEF CON, I did speak briefly about GDPR with a couple of people, and they always seem to go a little bit pale when you started talking about it.
Yeah, I think there's certainly going to be a heavy burden on companies in the beginning. As we've said, they really need to find out where all the data is. And I mean, there's always been a suspicion that companies really don't know. And particularly in these days of cloud services, if you're putting data onto a cloud service, you've no idea, frankly, where it's ending up. And that's going to be a problem to actually rein that back in and to make sure that the data you've already put up there can be deleted, can be forgotten.
Now, of course, Senatas, over the last few years, has been promoting its SureDrop service. This is like an encrypted, I suppose the easiest way to describe it is it's like an encrypted sort of enterprise-grade version of Dropbox and similar services. But there's also a key management element to it that you feel is going to be important once this regime kicks in.
Yes, that's right, because one of the problems we have with cloud services is ownership of the data. So once you upload data into the cloud, yes, it's going to be encrypted in its storage location, wherever that will be. But effectively, you have lost ownership of the data because the keys that are used to encrypt it are now owned by the cloud services provider. ShoreDrop actually differs in that respect, in that you will be able to have your key store on your site. You'll be able to have the key. You'll continue to own the keys for the data, no matter where it's located. So you can still upload your data to the cloud, but you own the keys. And that's going to be a critical factor when it comes to ensuring deletion of the data and safe storage of the data.
Yeah, well, I guess you can just nuke the keys, can't you?
Exactly what I was going to say. So you can nuke the keys. Now that data is just so much garbage sitting in the cloud. So that's going to be really important for people to have that kind of control, because you can't mandate large cloud providers to delete the keys and be sure that they did.
Well, I guess straight up, man, if you're going to be GDPR compliant, it's going to make using Dropbox very hard.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we saw on our roadshow was that companies are using Dropbox, and it's very hard for the management and indeed for the security teams in companies to prevent this kind of insecure use of cloud services. Because let's be honest, they're really convenient, really well done. And it's...
Well, it's just about offering people a better alternative, right? Which is, you know, why you were doing what you were doing.
Well, absolutely. And it's something that companies are going to need to look at, because putting data on these shared services does have attached risk.
Graham Wallace, thank you very much for joining us to have a bit of a chat about GDPR and, you know, how that's all shaping up in the EU.
Thank you very much.
That was Graham Wallace of Senetas there. If you need some layer 2 encryption gear, they are your people. They, of course, also offer their ShoreDrop file sharing service, so do go have a look at that. I should note, too, that we were throwing a bit of shade at Dropbox there, but apparently they are working to become compliant with the GDPR. I'm not sure if this compliance means unauthorized use by employees is covered, though, so yeah, that's probably a little bit complicated. But anyway, that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.